it all of a sudden brings home the fact that the Earth is a relatively small place. Right? We have a much, in this day and age, we have a much different conception of how big the Earth is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's hard to see the pictures from the moon, right, with the Earth floating in blackness and not say, oh yeah, we are a vulnerable little planet.
Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local FM radio, Franklin FM radio dial 102.9. Another session on making sense of climate. We are in the studio again. Tad, thanks for joining me again to continue this journey. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Steve. Great to be here again.
Oh, good. It's good to have you. So you just started telling me what you had for breakfast, which I think was all interesting, but then there was a combination. So repeat that combination. That caught my ear.
I have taken to having for breakfast oatmeal. A lot of people have oatmeal for breakfast.
Sure.
But my own peccadilloes pushed me towards having chopped up pickled jalapeno. Right, hot, like Mexican jalapeno, along with, say, blueberries. This morning I had jalapeno, blueberry, strawberry, raisins, and a little bit of flax in my oatmeal. It was delicious.
So oatmeal is by and is of itself fibrous, but you added the other fruit and flavors, and the jalapeno caught me, because I've had, I think it was a jalapeno chocolate beer, which... I had once, and I always say I'll have a beer once. I may not have it the second time. That was one that, you know, if you're truly, you know, on a bowl of nachos or Tostitos, etc., the jalapeno could get broken by that, etc. But to just have that beer on a sunny day, no, that's not for my taste. But you have jalapenos on a fairly regular basis.
I highly recommend, if you have not had strawberry rhubarb jalapeno jelly jam, you can get it in springtime. Somebody here in Franklin sells it. Delicious. And the reason, one of the reasons that I think it is good is, I saw this on TV with Alan Alda. Remember, you used to have some kind of a show about science, right?
Yep.
And they were doing, they were investigating what are called super tasters.
Yes.
Right? And that somehow the capsaicin, which is the stuff that's in the jalapeno that makes it hot, activates your taste buds in a way. So if you have the jalapeno, then other things taste better with it because your taste buds are all going crazy.
Right.
Ipso facto. Jalapeno in my oatmeal, my otherwise bland morning gruel of steel-cut oatmeal.
The steel-cut oatmeal itself is bland, but you've added enough to it so that it's not bland anymore between the blueberries, the flax, etc.
I just hope it's still healthy. If you put in enough, you know, a little bit of honey, a little bit of maple syrup, pretty soon it's like
It sounds like
ice cream.
They're at least not the refined sugars. They're kind of the, I'll say raw, there's probably a better term for it, more of a natural sugar. Right?
Yes.
Delivery mechanism in that case. But
go.
Anyway, having jumped in through breakfast, which I think you cooked on your induction stove.
On my induction.
So we have a climate connection with that.
And it's wonderful because the induction plate that I have has a timer on it. And you can set the power level. You can set the temperature of the pan, which is fascinating. In other words, you can say, I want this pan to be at 200 degrees Fahrenheit, just below boiling, and I want it to be there for 20 minutes, and the induction plate will keep it there for you.
Ooh.
So there are different, when you have an induction plate, there are different options about how to cook, ways you wouldn't think of, because if you just have a gas flame, you can turn the gas flame up and down.
But you still have to look at it.
You have to be monitoring it, because it's just putting out full power.
Yeah.
If you set the temperature, then the hot plate, it will lower the power to keep the pan at the temperature you've set.
It's got a feedback mechanism in there, so it becomes more of a smart device. And I use smart. The air quotes are out there. You may not be able to see them, but you can listen to the air quotes.
There are air quotes there that are... I saw it, Steve. So the air quotes exist. And anyway, jalapeno, I highly recommend it. If you want to liven up your morning and make you say...
So you had that probably ruminating after the recent State of the Union address one evening last week?
Yeah, the next morning I got up and had my my oatmeal. But yes, our president, Joe Biden, I guess, gave a State of the Union that it seems to have been well received, right? Proves that he's a proof of life, that he's still hanging in there. God bless him. And I think he did a very good job. One of the, from a climate perspective, State of the Union addresses are interesting because it sort of tells you the temperature, to coin a phrase, the mood and the attitude of the administration and the country towards climate stuff.
Right.
So I'm old enough to remember when George W. Bush was giving, and you would sit there waiting for a reference, or when Obama would give a State of the Union and wait for a reference. Oh, please mention something about it, and you dissect.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
Joe Biden made a pretty committed, was committed to climate change.
Yes.
Right? And he, mostly what he talked about was the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act, which is curiously named Climate Bill, provides lots and lots of money, clean energy stuff, right? And in particular, I guess he came out with a reference to a big automotive plant somewhere in Ohio.
Yes.
That was about to shut down, but now with this money he's hired 10,000 people to make batteries for electric vehicles. And this is touted as a thing that was on its way out, but it's now been Americanized, and you know, we're building the stuff here and it's clean.
Reinvigorating.
It's all good, 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 good. So, I mean, that kind of message, I think, works well in a political sense, because people who are not directly aware of the consequences of climate change is still, like, you know, you and me and people listening to this are probably, you know, on the bell curve, we're pretty far out, right? Most people, well, that's less true than it used to be, but, you know, most people are not motivated, right? And so to tell them that there are jobs associated with fixing climate, and it's a true thing, it's a good thing. So he spent some time talking about that. And it just signifies that the Biden administration is committed, although I would think they're also, they're by definition, political animals. They're subject to political forces. And I think that's one of the things that made Joe Biden an intriguing character, because he is amenable to public pressure. He does respond when people get mad at him, and I think in 2020 he responded to the youth movement that was demanding climate action. He said, okay, he recognized that. I think there's some risk that he's frittering that away, but now I'm talking politics. But he did a good job in the State of the Union. I think what it does is reflects that the country is more heavily committed and more accepting of good work on climate than it used to be.
Yeah, I think there is, clearly, it's also a political event. While it was State of the Union, clearly from the administration perspective, and we've heard other State of Unions from other administrations, but this was this time, this year, these statuses. I think also he's really speaking to two audiences. He's campaigning, so he's got a public audience, very clearly very political to that extent. And yet he's got a congressional audience, which he came from. He spent an awful lot of time working the aisles. And it was clear when even he came down the aisle entering, he's hobnobbing with a number of the people he's worked with and even worked to cross the aisles with. He engaged with people who were clearly not on his party, right? So he's that kind of making things happen, as opposed to, you know, my way or the highway. This is not him. He's going to work out a deal and find the best of both to bring forward to make it happen. There are some things, and at least being mindful, clearly in my role as reporter for Franklin and focusing on Franklin, he also drew a lot of applause, you know, give teachers a raise. Well, yeah, I appreciate that. That's good. Great for focus. But in that audience, they don't have any skin in the game to do that unless they go home to their local community and do something at the local level. Because at least as far as I'm aware, there's never been any federal legislation that said this is the teacher's salary. right? They may have teacher requirements, so they may have teacher grants.
There's money that comes from the Fed, though, right?
From the Fed through specific programs. So, yes, as far as I'm aware, there's Title I benefits for that Franklin gets on a regular basis because of the students within Franklin that are Title I qualified. And thereby, they get additional funds for that purpose. But in terms of general funds for an operation to provide a salary for teacher, no, not to my awareness, no. So, yeah, soundbite, worthy. Enforcement for the teachers, yes, that's happy. Now they can say, well, even Joe says give us a raid, right? So there's nothing wrong with that. But in terms of reality,
well, I think that it still comes back. On the climate front, there would, for example, one of the things that the Biden administration is pushing for a climate front is something called 30 by 30, which is to preserve 30% of American land by the year 2030.
Right.
And so 30% of America is a lot.
That's a lot of land.
Most of it is probably in federal lands out west. Mm-hmm. But I guess the pushback is that it's the same kind of sounds great, harder to do,
right.
But it's an applause line that we should be doing.
Well, and especially since, and I know the current natural resources director, who now is of Native heritage, she's trying to work to undo some of the, like, mining and or drilling things that have been permitted on, you know, conservation land, resource land, which it begs the question. Okay, yes, in a perfect world, that sounds like it might be a good thing to do. But in a world where we know climate is going to be a factor, and if you're pulling out, you know, fossil stuff, don't. But that kind of decision is going to have to go through the process because it got started. It may be along the way. And now how do you undo it?
Just got to go off into left field for 1 second. We both read the book, highly recommended, dear listener, of The Ministry for the Future.
Yeah, I finally finished it.
Part of The Ministry for the Future, there was this other program of rewilding the world.
Yes.
Right? Which has, so what is that rewilding? I can't say I know in detail, but it's basically allowing natural processes to recapture carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only do that by, number one, not putting asphalt on top of it, right? Not blacktopping the whole world, right?
Yeah.
But somehow reintroducing the animals, which then support,
right?
I mean, curiously enough, like the like megafauna, the wolves and whatnot, have an important role, beavers.
I was going to reference the wolves in particular because, folks, that's at least been in the articles in many cases where by reintroducing the wolves into Yellowstone and other parks in Midwest, their population has started coming up, which, yo, verily, that's supposed to be good. And now they're at least starting to restore that balance. And remember, there's a circle of life. Little things get eaten by bigger things, and so forth. By having pulled the wolves out, it disrupted that cycle. They're reintroducing them. So now, over time, there should be a better balance among the natural population. The question for us in New England is, okay, how can we have so many turkeys and how many have so many black bears and deer? Is that because things are now coming back, or was there something taken out that disturbed the balance, which is why we're in the situation we're in? So to that extent, I mean, we can see the examples. Is it talked about from a climate perspective? Not all the time that I've seen. No.
But I mean, but the rewilding thing is a way to reestablish carbon balance.
Yes.
Right? And we started with a book, and it comes up in the book, which is just, it's not a major part of the book, but it is, they do talk about it as one of the things that is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And just the last, so I like to swim on Cape Cod, and you may or may not have noticed, there's many more great white sharks, right?
Appearing,
and that's because the great white sharks are coming after the seal population, which is somehow more abundant down in Chatham, like at the elbow of Cape Cod.
Sure.
That's where all the great whites are. And the question is that why is the seal population back? To your point about, is it disruption or is it recovery that you're seeing by having the turkeys walking through your backyard?
There's been other, and I think we talked about kind of the air tracks for the ocean liners and the airplanes, etc. But there's also some articles that have been recently, I'm not sure if we referenced it specifically here, but we can find some links about the ocean current And the major currents that, according to some projections, are at a point of disruption, so the current may change its normal order. And that clockwise rotation that exists in the Atlantic today may get disrupted, and people aren't sure what's going to happen in that. So maybe it's the seals that are there because they're chasing
their fish, which are now moving up further. I mean, just now we're way far from the State of the Union, but everyone's heard of the Gulf Stream,
yes,
which is the circulation you're referring to. The Gulf Stream carries warm water for various reasons we can go into. Up the east coast of the U.S. and then down past England.
Mm-hmm.
And that warming water has kept England warm for a long time. And the reason that this is important, that the Gulf Stream even works, is because as that warm water goes northward, the saltier, cold water in the north pushes the warm water down somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the driver, the pump that is what's called the thermohaline, salty, hot, salt, cold, salty water, right, mm-hmm, driving this thing.
Right.
As the Greenland ice sheet melts, the water up there is less salty, so
right,
the pump breaks down. And if the pump breaks down, which is to say the Gulf Stream slows down, then England freezes. Because if you look on a map, we talked about a map last week, right? If you look on a map, England is way far north.
Sure.
Farther north than we are.
Yeah.
But it's warm in, you know, the beautiful islands.
Miserably humid and wet a lot because of the environment there.
Because of the Gulf Stream looping back down. And if the Gulf Stream collapses and England turns into Finland, well, it sucks being in England.
Mm.
But, of course, it would also have an impact here in the U.S. if the Gulf Stream collapses, blah, blah, blah,
right,
blah, blah.
Right.
But it's not going to happen if we get on the stick and cut carbon dioxide emissions.
Which is the whole reason for trying to do what we're doing in terms of making sense of climate. And, yeah, it's a challenge. One other article recently that you had shared, and it's appropriate because at one point I think we even talked with our state rep Jeff Roy about the sense meter and monitor. There was an article in the Globe where other things were referenced, but also it quoted that particular company in their development. So it's effectively in your home, you've got an electrical panel. And
this is no longer about the Gulf Stream.
We've no longer switched. Gulf Stream.
We're down in your basement.
Down in the basement.
At your electrical panel in the basement. Go.
And this device could help diagnose your electrical use, and on your phone app, give you kind of a heat map, so to speak. You know, large bubbles, small bubbles, depending upon the use by each of the devices. It kind of learns, it uses AI to say this particular electrical band stream signal looks like this is going to be a plug for a light, this is going to be a plug for a toaster, this is going to be a plug for, you know, whatever the devices are. And it learns over time and then gives you an opportunity to say, yay, verily, this is the one in the kitchen, this is the one in the bedroom, etc. I had piloted and installed that in my prior house. People may remember we just moved. So I'm missing the fact that we would be getting into our second year of having learned and seeing how that could be used. So I'll have to go back and knock on the new neighbor of the old house and say, have you started using it? What is it like for you? Because I don't have that second year. Although going back to Jeff Roy, we could bring him back because I believe he has that at home. And I believe he also, because he had teased it up, was also going to Sense to learn how to read the reports and find out from them. So
the question is, why is that important? Monitoring of the circuit breaker in the basement of the house. Why would you care? Why does it matter what your toaster's doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that as a state, Massachusetts needs to help homeowners do something called decarbonize their homes. And that's a fancy way of saying to get rid of the natural gas in your house.
And other fossil fuels.
And other fossil, whatever, yeah, natural gas, oil, wood,
oil,
whatever,
right,
whatever you're using, get rid of that and basically run your house on electricity. But, and everyone says, sure, great, you know, I can do that. But when you start to think about it, all of this sort of energy content that was in the fossil fuel, the natural gas and whatnot, all that heat that warmed your house up, right, that now has to come from electricity. And ipso facto, second time I've used that, right, by all of a sudden you need more electricity to replace the fossil fuels that you're no longer coming in the door, right?
Sure.
Most homes, or many homes in the state, do not have enough capacity to handle that electrical power in their circuit breaker, right?
Right.
And upgrading the circuit breaker, so then this bespeaks a whole other issue.
Well, I think technically it's not just upgrading a circuit breaker, it's upgrading the entire panel in many cases, because the panel is set for whether it's 100 amp, 200 amp. In some cases, you'd have to go 400, 600 or whatever, and we're not electricians. Talk to an electrician to figure it out. Right. But that's not an easy process, and it's also fairly costly.
Those are the buzzwords. Most people have a 100-amp panel, which means, basically what that means is this: the thickness of the copper wires coming into your house is sufficient to carry 100 amps. If you go more than 100 amps, the wires are going to get hot and start a fire or something, right? So you're limited to 100. I think nowadays a lot of people want to have 200 amp service, which is more, again, and they can do that by putting a second wire in or putting thicker wires in, but it requires a physical change to that whole circuit panel.
Right.
Okay. So fine, you're thinking about putting in more electrical components in your home, you're going to have more electricity coming into your home. All of a sudden the question becomes, how do you manage that if you can't get a 200 amp panel? You still want to do stuff, you're limited by the 100 amps. Now you need a smart panel that says, oh, wait a minute, your toaster's on, turn off the toaster and then we'll turn on the dishwasher, because you got to stay under this 100 amp limit.
Right.
And it's a much cheaper path to getting the decarbonization, getting rid of the fossil fuels, replacing things with, say, replacing your hot water heater, which may be natural gas now, with a heat pump. Right, which heat pump hot water heater, which then requires more electricity. Well, this panel can manage that. So the gist of this article was that even though as you decarbonize your home, there may be more electricity coming into it, these smart meters are able to cleverly manage that so you don't exceed the current limit, the electrical current limit that your house has.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Yeah, and over time, clearly, as the smart panels come in, it may make sense, it may be justifiable to get a new panel with the smartness built in. Or I think there are cases where you keep your 100-amp panel, you add a panel if you've got an electric vehicle and you need to charge, so at least you get the separate charging power, because the 100-amp, as I understand, wouldn't charge the car at the same time. And then having at least that second one, based on what I've heard through other sources as well, you can also time so that the charge is being done in kind of the off hour, say 2 o'clock in the morning while you're sleeping, you're not using the car, better utilizes the electricity in the entire grid at that point. And then if you want to start making the road or taking that road down in terms of metering, coincidentally, the library has some items to, quote, borrow from the library in their Internet of Things or item of things, and it's got a meter device. So you can take a meter, register, assuming it's available. And from what I understand, there's a fairly good demand, so you may be on a wait list, but you can get one, plug it in. I believe it's only one device at a time, but it'll tell you, yay, verily, how much it's going to take over whatever period you've got it plugged in.
For example, I mean, I have one, right? And it is very simple little thing. It's you know the Christmas tree ornaments, sometimes they have like a double plug, you can plug one unit into it.
Sure.
Well, it's got a little plug like that. You plug that thing into the outlet, and then your
toaster, say
for example, you plug into that. And then when you toast, this little meter, which is right beside the toaster, says, oh yeah, you're using X number of amps, that's how much power you're using.
Right.
And so you can walk around the house, and for example, you could take it and plug your computer in. So this just goes into the wall, you plug, right, and then the computer goes, the AC plug goes into the
device.
And, and all of a sudden you say, yeah, when I am not using my computer, it's just sitting there consuming
still,
X amount of power all the time.
Right.
And it just allows you to become familiar, which is really important. I think the challenge that we have in decarbonizing our homes is a thing that, like, nobody really wants to think about it. God mm-hmm. bless us all. Everyone's busy, right?
Well, to the extent that where do we begin? This is one place to begin.
Right.
Awareness is always the first step.
And this is a tiny baby step that you can take to just to say, yeah, one time I measured that. Right? Mm-hmm. And now I sort of have a better feel for, you know, I got a whole house here. What am I going to do there? Then you talk about, for example, this smart sense meter.
Sense meter,
but it is, as I say, the whole provision of electricity for the future, when we're going to be driving our cars with electricity, heating our homes with electricity, and that is an important thing to at least become conscious of. You're probably not going to be an expert. But then when you see the governor or your state representative talking about installing more wind turbines, how important it is to have those wind turbines, well, all of a sudden the penny drops. Yeah, we need that wind turbine because that's going to drive my car right, mm-hmm. going forward.
Right.
And all this stuff comes together. And it's hard to be an expert in it, but at least the awareness that this stuff's going on is important.
Yeah, I think currently it's, 60 to 80% of our current electricity is generated from natural gas. And they want to shift. We need to shift to whether it's solar or wind. And the wind farms at least are starting to provide some of that power. And yeah, verily, at some point in time, the fossil fuel plants can either shut down or shift to some other methodology if they choose. And I know there's a number of pockets in regards to geothermal.
Mm-hmm.
Both Eversource mm-hmm. and National Grid have geothermal pilots underway, which in a prior episode we talked about kind of reutilizing the pipes, because right now the pipes that bring the natural gas to the home could be, you know, an expendable resource, but it cost money to put in. The pipe is still there. It may, in fact, be valid, other than in some cases there may be some leaks. But if they were able to repurpose the pipe to now send kind of that geothermal air or geothermal water or fluid, because it may be more than water, it may be some other fluid, into service and provide our heating needs that way. Now we've reutilized something as well as, you know, so.
I mean, you're touching on so many interesting things that are, again, vocabulary words that people, I mean, something called a stranded asset, which mm-hmm. sounds really obscure and opaque, but a stranded asset is when the gas company has a whole bunch of pipes in the ground that used to carry natural gas, but nobody's using natural gas anymore. So they spent billions of dollars building this thing, but it's stranded and they can't do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
So one way out is to try to reutilize those things by, and just meet the geothermal projects are lovely, conceptually great. Mm-hmm. The way they work is important to understand. The way they work is that every house on a block has heat pumps in it. But all those heat pumps, instead of using the outside air to get the heat from, they use the water from a geothermal well, which tends to be the water. If you dig a hole into the ground, get the water from 500 feet down, it's all year long. It is 50 degrees,
mm-hmm.
whether freezing cold or screaming hot,
right.
At the top. So in the summer, you use it to cool. In the winter, you use it to heat. But what you do, you're not actually using the water. That is just the reference point for the heat pump to dump its heat
conversion.
Into or do the conversion. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful, and it's even more efficient and better than the, what are called air source heat pumps, which is most of what you get nowadays, which
right.
is why these projects are good for urban areas where there's pipes in the ground, there's all this stuff already,
mm-hmm.
lots of houses close together. It's a great scheme, and the utilities have been either forced or agreed to do these pilot projects, and there's one in Framingham, and it's a great thing.
Yeah, so we're certainly keeping an eye on that as it continues to go. I believe it's still got some time to run to prove the concept, develop some numbers, look at the costs, et cetera. At some point in time, assuming it's good, they'll also have kind of, you know, the switchover in the implementation time. And that's going to be tricky because, you know, at some point in time, one day you're getting your pipe as natural gas. The next day, pipe's not getting natural gas.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to be done in a coordinated way.
Clearly.
And I think be fair, maybe they would have to put different pipes in, but the utilities already own the right of ways. They know how to put pipes in. They've got people that have done it for decades, you know, employees. And right. So the whole
reuse, repurposing. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. It should minimize the cost as opposed to being, you know, a big enchilada of a bill to swallow.
I mean, I think that the question of how to, again, decarbonize is a funny word, right? You get used to saying it, but it is getting the stuff out of your house, getting the natural gas and fossil fuels, the oil, the coal, whatever it is you're using, to stop using that. And there are baby steps. We joked before about an induction hot plate, but that is a baby step that you can go to Amazon and for $50 you get a single hot plate and you can play games. You'd be surprised how much fun it is to cook on an induction hot plate. Mm-hmm. But it's the baby step that breaks the ice, so to speak. You've done it. You say, oh yeah, okay. I mean, the sun still came up the next morning, and now I can think about I'm more open to other things.
That you Right. Yeah, and that's going to be one of the challenges, because as we've just moved from one house to another, I lost electric. Now we're in gas. So at some point in time, I'm going to have to deal with that gas stove. And yeah, the induction burner would be an option step forward. So yeah, on our radar to start to help figure out how we're going to do that in our own environment.
I think one of the things to do when you talk about decarbonization of your home, right? Not to panic, not to feel pressured, but the simple preparatory thing to do is to look at your house and say, where am I burning fossil fuels now? And typically it's heating hot water, your home heater, your stove. And you say, which one of those things is going to break first?
Right.
And just start thinking about what would happen if the hot water heater went out, right? What would I do? And that gives you, because you should not replace the stuff until it reaches what's called the end of life.
Correct.
Because that's the most economical time to replace and decarbonize, is when the thing you have is exhausted its useful life.
Sure.
So the simple way to begin your decarbonization process is just to look around and say, gee, in 2 years, like in my own home, I've got going on 30 plus years on the natural gas heater in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
I know that guy's heading for the great big roundup, right? At some point. And so I am trying to think about what could I do if this thing fails? What are my options? I learn about it. And then you're ahead of the game when the time comes.
Right. Yeah, because you'd have to at least explored, potentially got an estimate or two, lined up a vendor or two. What are the options? How much is it going to cost? Are there going to be grants available? Clearly, grants and incentives like that may come and go. Maybe they'll be in the sweet spot by the time you're ready, as opposed to having just expired when you're ready.
Well, just to bring it all back to our friend Joe Biden in the State of the Union, the Inflation Reduction Act presents lots of money, but there's money for individual people to get a rebate for doing some of this kind of work.
Correct.
And, I mean, the knock on it is, I think that it's a lot of tax rebates. And so you have to pay taxes in order to get the rebate, which cuts out people who may not be in that bracket, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I think the Biden administration is very conscious of that fact. They're making efforts to be sure that everyone can participate in the programs, right?
Yeah.
But there is money.
Well, and I think respectfully, too, to the extent that at least Franklin, 80% of our residents are single family homes, you target the single family homes. There's going to be some number of those. That's a big chunk across the U.S. That's where those homeowners would be potentially the ones to make that change. Mm-hmm. Granted, we still haven't done the renters and or the lower income seniors. How do they get into those? And maybe that's where they're now getting into the other programs that would address those, potentially even like the housing authority that Franklin has. Have those homes been covered in such a way, et cetera? And I think they actually have heat pumps based on what I've seen around Central Park Terrace. So they've at least done something on that space. But that's going to have to be done not just here, but elsewhere as part of the overall plan.
Yeah. I mean, it's just important to recognize that there's all sorts of circumstances out there, and everyone needs to come along on this journey And they,
Right. And I think one of the other, back to the State of the Union piece, one of the other points he subtly made, but it was also taken, I think, justly by both sides. One applauded, the other one just kind of sat, because they verily, they did not approve of that. And yet, as the money is now available in their communities, oh, by the way, they're touting the receipt of that money and utilizing it. They're not turning it away.
No one turns down money. Nobody turns down money. So let me tell you one other story, which then goes off into a whole other
Okay, seatbelt fastened. Here we go.
Keep your hands inside the So on April 8th, coming April 8th, there's going to be a eclipse of the sun, total eclipse of the sun.
Yes. Right? I've heard about that.
It is, it turns out that the eclipse will, so what's an eclipse? Eclipse is when the moon in its orbit happens to be in front of the sun, between the Earth and the sun.
Right, so we don't see the sun directly. It kind of blocks it out.
Kind of blocks it out. And, of course, that is on, it, as it happens, the shadow of the moon shadow, to coin a phrase, is on a fairly narrow path. I mean, it's much smaller than the Earth. So depending on where you are, you might see totality or a partial eclipse or whatever.
And Franklin, as I understand it, is more in a partial area. We're not in a totality area.
The totality, so when it, when the sun is completely blocked out by the moon, is basically on a path that goes like from Buffalo, New York, to Burlington, and then up into Canada. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's going to happen in the U.S. The next one is not until like 2078 or something. Right.
Right. Sometime later.
And so I am hoping to go up and be part of the total, even though, you know, Franklin will get some of it, I would like to experience the total eclipse. So we're going to drive up into New Hampshire and Vermont and try and be in this magical place.
Mm-hmm. And see the darkness come.
My plan is to run around screaming, saying that we're all going to die and we have to sacrifice a goat to bring the sun back, right? But the reason I mention it is because it is a moment when you think about the moon blocking out the sun, and you think about the planet and its relative to the other celestial bodies that we know about, the sun. It all of a sudden brings home the fact that the Earth is a relatively small place. Right? We have a much, in this day and age, we have a much different conception of how big the Earth is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's hard to see the pictures from the moon, right, with the Earth floating in blackness and not say, oh yeah, we are a vulnerable little planet. And the idea that the shadow of the moon will run across the United States on that day, I think is important to just recognize and say, yes, we humans are part of a continuum. We're on this planet. We do not dominate the planet. We can do nothing about the position of the sun and the moon. They are where they are. This stuff happens, right? And it is in our interest to try, as a species, to try and be in synchrony, in concert, in harmony with the rest of the stuff that's happening around us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as you can well guess, this rewinds back to climate, right? Is that we need to live here on this planet, this little thing that's getting the shadow of the moon on it, right? We need to be thoughtful about how we live here. And there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we're coming up soon on the solstice. I mean, all these celestial things are fascinating. But the fact that when the eclipse comes along, it's cool. Don't look at it, right?
Not directly.
Don't directly look at it, but just sort of take a spiritual moment and say, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm. So two points. One, we'll talk about the library and resources. So, oh, by the way, you should not look at it directly. They have some workshops. They also have some safety goggles, et cetera, so you can at least look and take photos, because, your camera would get destroyed if you took a shot directly because of the power of the umbra, I think is the proper term, of the sun, and by being shaded, it becomes more powerful. It looks a little slimmer, but oh, by the way, the power is there. And then the second piece, going back to, you know, we're on this journey. We, you and I specifically on this journey, started at a certain date. Who knows when we're going to go? Hopefully for a good while more for us. But at some point in time, people did go running and screaming because the sun got blocked out and they didn't know what it was. So that began the story making, the analogies that they would tell. And then over time, we're spinning through time rather fast in this analogy's tale. People start making better sense of it, using more science, more scientific measures. Now we can measure the tracking and come down to the detail and produce a map as to where the point is going to be on a certain day. That never happened years and years ago. That was we had not the capabilities. But to our point, we have the capability. We're not that we're perfect, but we have the ability to do that. And we've come a long way. We still have a ways to go. And it would be nice if the Earth was still here allowing us to continue to go.
I think that knowledge brings responsibility.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, as you see this stuff, you can't pretend that you don't know that these things are real and that you are a sort of this godlike player.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Humans do affect things now.
Right.
And
sure.
It's although I would just say that the last time I was in an eclipse, this is probably 20 years ago, I mean, the pinhole camera, I'm sure they'll talk about that at the mm-hmm. library, the pinhole camera is basically it's like a piece of blank paper, and you punch a little hole in it that's maybe eighth of an inch kind of
yep,
thing.
Yep.
And if you play with that, you can reproduce an image of the sun on the ground just by holding it.
Sure.
And it's a much safer way to see the eclipse.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I know in a recent episode, we'll give that the plug. Mitzi Guzzi and I spent time to talk about all the library events during March. You can go to that. She's got a couple events specifically and also a resource sheet so that there are some devices that are available that are supposedly, sun protections that the EPA says or whatever the specific org, I forget. They're not actually valid. So she's got a specific these are the valid ones that will give you the protection, as opposed to whatever's the cheap one out there. Don't buy the cheap one because you may not get protected. And you've got one eye or two eyes. Take care of them. Don't lose your sight because of
don't look at it with sunglasses. Your sunglasses are not going to protect you because it's like, if you look directly at the sun with no moon there, you wouldn't be able to do it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And just because the moon is there, there's still enough power coming around the edges
right.
that you're in real trouble if you stare directly at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's another whole set of science doesn't touch us, potentially at least, all the solar flares that happen that do then affect the internet and the radios and broadcasts and all that other kind of stuff. I mean, those are things that clearly they're not in our perspective because we don't see those. They're in the air, and yet they do affect us, and we do get static, and we hear the static, but that's about the only time we do,
well,
right?
There's a scientific case that's been made that the charged particles from the sun that essentially follow the magnetic field lines and shoot down at the North Pole, mm-hmm. creating the aurora, also have a role to play in weather creation,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating, so that the solar flares blowing charged particles off the sun that come zooming at us, in addition to creating all these electrical sort of communications issues, conceivably have something to do with weather.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
It is. It is. It's
everything's connected, as the philosopher said.
Yep. Shin bone connected to the thin bone, connected to the thigh bone, connected to the hip bone, and we're all connected, whether it's 6 degrees of separation or otherwise. We're all connected. So, we've talked for a bit. We've kind of gone roundabout. We started in a place, odd for other than for the induction burn, a tie we made to it, but with breakfast and jalapeno and blueberries and flax, etc. Touched on the State of the Union. Touched on the eclipse. Touched on monitors. Touched on a few topics. So thank you for helping me make sense of climate in this period for this time. And we'll schedule again to come back and continue our journey.
That's great. I'll be here.
And listeners, thank you for listening. If you have a particular question or topic that, hey, maybe you and Ted can talk about it sometime, by all means, reach out. Our contact info is on the pages, in the show notes, etc. You can always send something to us and we'll get it in a future episode. So thank you again, Ted. And listeners, thank you for listening. And we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.